Well, it's a case of some strange bedfellows this week. On the hate crime bill, there we have. Nothing much actually happened at the Old Firm match, despite all the predictions. Does that suggest that, whoa, look, there was no problem with the hate crime bill because we didn't have an eruption of difficulty? Or that it was no point because clearly what was being sung by one side was pretty offensive? So we discuss, we look also at the situation in Gaza. How can it possibly be that, obviously driven entirely by the SNP, the Tories are now actually ending up having a tougher stance, calling for a ban on arms sales to Israel, than Labour, who are just, where are they? You could actually say the same actually for Labour on the hate crime bill in Scotland. We look also at land reform and the bill that's going through Parliament, and a little bit of distinction on the water situation, as Thames Water looks like it's heading for renationalisation. Will the Scots end up coughing up through our income tax for that, despite our own water being in public ownership? Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, chums, and welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast. So with a cheery smile, here we go, here we go, here we go. And those of you who understand football, or even know a little bit about it, that is a common football chant. And I, for my sins, because I do not come from a background, obviously, that supports the Rangers, nor do I support the Celtic, despite what many people say. What's your real team, Joyce? No, I am a Dundonian, and the one thing other than leg spin bowling my father instilled in me was I was going to support a Dundee team. And that was it. There was absolutely no doubt that I was going to support a Dundee team, and I opted for Dundee United, purely by happenstance. But there we go. But yes, I tuned in to the what is referred in some circles still as the Old Firm Derby, but in others, and we've got to be neutral on this, as the Glasgow Derby, given the circumstances of Rangers going into an administration. And within a minute, even though Ali McCoist was not there because he suddenly discovered someplace else to go to, out came the Billy Boys, and they were up to the knees in Fenian blood, and the world did not come to an end. Did it, despite
I must say, I don't know if it did or didn't, because at that point I was in London, which is another story, but doing the Trevor Phillips program on Sky News, so I was kind of off piste for this, although watching to see whether this deluge, the predicted deluge of arrests, happened, and the deluge of bad behavior. So I don't know which it was. I mean, if you know, you'd kind of think that is, that probably does fit the bill, threatening or abuse of an intended to stir up hatred. And I mean, you'd know better than me, but I mean, I think a lot of people felt that song was kind of pretty much, was that not outlawed by a whole lot of previous
Yes,
stuff?
It was deemed to be, it was deemed racist by UEFA. And it should not. I mean, and to be honest about it, I mean, the other thing about it is, Leslie, that the whole Billy Boys thing is based upon the Bridgeton Billy Boys, a 1920s razor gang founded by Billy Fullerton, interesting man, member of the British Union of Fascists, established the Ku Klux Klan in Glasgow, and had at one point 500 members in the Billy Boys who went around razoring people. And you know, they were against gangs like the Norman Conks, etc., which were Roman Catholic gangs. So, yeah, a charmer, a fascist. And there we go. That's that song.
But what happened? You were watching it.
Oh,
then.
Nothing. Nothing happened.
So did the police move in to arrest people? Because it relies on complaints, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think.
And have we become, I mean, my perspective is, I mean, and McCoist actually came out and said it, said something that actually revealed the reality of the situation, is that, you know, you go to football matches, I go to football matches, and I do not display my political colours at that, even though some people will say supporting, not supporting Celtic is a political statement on my part. But the thing about it is that, no, this is just so part of the territory, Leslie. I mean, when Rangers came to Tannadice, so the couple of seasons that we were back in the Premier League, I mean, this was ringing out all through the ground and roundly booed, you know. But it's just, it's par for the course.
Yeah, but then isn't the thing, because this is the weird thing about the hate crime bill, because either it isn't changing the world and you aren't in a situation where you're not allowed to sort of even think something dodgy about somebody, that's untrue. Or what's the point of it then?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bit weird, because, I mean, it's almost like both ways.
you know, you can look at it on either side. You can either say, look, it hasn't brought the world to an end, despite all the worst mm-hmm. predictions of everybody. And then you slightly wonder, I don't know what the point is. But then I suppose the point is more that if you're one person at the kind of targeted end of abuse, you have the expectation that if you can prove that it was about anything that you are, disabled, Catholic, you know, kind of trans, gay, whatever, you can then expect the perpetrator to get a kind of basically stiffer sentence. Now, whether that works its way back to stopping anybody being a BAM, it's hard to know. And it would seem that this is kind of, you know, there's evidence there that it takes a long time to decouple this. I mean, I was watching Angela Constance, who's the relevant minister, on Scotland Tonight last night. And I mean, I've got to say, it was a pretty wooden performance. And I'm sure people would say, well, I don't, you know, it may be that it's just not possible to be more than wooden about a lot of this stuff, because the second you kind of slightly try to explain stuff in ordinary language, you just find yourself in kind of basically deep doo-doo, you know. But making a parallel, as she did, with the changes, or in fact, she was quoting Helena Kennedy, who is doing this, who has done the separate report on misogyny, which she, in fact, recommended should be a separate bit of legislation, which then kind of, you know, that did annoy, because all of this sits on a very uneven bit of ground over gender recognition because of the previous gender recognition reform stuffy. But nonetheless, Helena Kennedy, a Labour peer, was the one who suggested that it should be is meaty enough to be a separate bit of legislation. And so it's not encompassed in the other characteristics in the hate crime bill. And, you know, there's a lot of people thinking, well, OK, I'm sure that sort of makes sense on paper. Yeah. But if you'd kind of been a bit canny and looked at how this would be received, there's already a feeling amongst feminist women, gender. I mean, I can't get the I just refuse to use the terminology of gender critical or whatever it is, because I can't get my head around it. But anyway, people who are kind of interested in women's rights, let's just say, I mean, they're already feeling a little bit on the back foot. And then they see a hate crime bill coming in with nothing about women in it. So you might think, how is that going to go down? And it's fair enough to actually say, which is true, that all of this arose from, as it were, third parties who were kind of beaks. You know, I mean, Baroness Helena Kennedy is a pretty, you know, notable kind of expert, legal expert and feminist. Lord Bracadale, who started the whole ball rolling to say there's too many bits sitting around in legislation and law enforcement officers don't know the bits. So they're often failing to use what law there is because it's all kind of scattered all over the place. I mean, you know, he said it a lot more poshly than that. But I mean, Lord Bracadale started this ball rolling. And so you can refer back to him, you know, as indeed the Scottish government would do. But there's a point where you can't really do a big boy did it and ran away. You know, sort of.
No, that's the unnecessary word.
Well, you know, I mean, in politics, there's a point where, you know, you can't just keep doing the sort of technocratic thing of saying somebody that's awfully kind of clever, basically with a kind of pointy head, came in. And actually totally independent from us. So, you know, that's feeling pretty good. And told us to do something that, you know, might just kind of not go down terribly well or not be understood or be weaponized. Let's just, you know, by bad actors, you know, or all of the above, right? Melee. It's your gig. That's your gig. You know, you're in that bit of the world. You're in the sort of, how will this actually get rolled out? And it's, you slightly see this in a lot of policy stances that the Scottish government have taken. I mean, I know this may seem an off a drift, but when you get back to things like the HPMAs, you know, the highly protected marine areas, with that, you know, consultation that actually Marine Scotland were responsible for, which was essentially asking island communities, would you like part of your coastline to have no fishing, no swimming in it, no nothing in it? And we'll decide where it is and you won't get compensation. How do you feel about that? That's called a consultation.
Yeah.
You know, and again, you know, somebody could come on and say, oh, but we ticked all the boxes. We did a consultation. You know, we asked people what they think. I mean, come on. There's a little bit of reality proof in at the end where you just go, does this feel like would a normal person, how would they hear this? So anyway, there's all of that. But I didn't see, you know, I would imagine that the police would have been quite faced with a pretty horrible situation, really, in the Old Firm match. And yet it seems to have kind of, you know, we seem to be on the slightly on the other side of it. I don't know how long this will go on, because everybody, well, I don't know, is it everybody is calling for this to be bucketed? I mean, I slightly missed some of this, but Jack McConnell's on this morning. It's funny, he's woken up on a lot of fronts. And just suddenly, you know, I don't know. So he's suddenly woken up and decided this should be binned. Anybody else? What's Labour's, you know, Sarwar's position, given that they voted for it?
Yeah, well, you've got the tumbleweed through the proverbial deserted Western town waiting for the shootout of the OK Corral, you know, going on with the Scottish Labour on that basis. But exactly what you were saying, Leslie, was the fact is that on so many occasions, you've made the point, both in articles and on the podcast, that why doesn't the Scottish government do the sensible thing rather than top down telling people through all this consultation with stakeholders? Why doesn't it actually hold citizens' assemblies? Why doesn't it actually speak to people? Have the evidence presented in front of them so there's a, I hate to use this word, bottom up rather than top down, if you know what I mean. You know, not being pejorative, but so people can be consulted about it across the spectrum in order to actually determine proper legislation which will not only garner support within the Scottish Parliament but can garner popular support. So I mean, it just seems to me that this is, a as you said, with the HPMAs and all sorts of other areas, gender recognition, why wasn't there proper consultation through citizens' assemblies in order to bring on board people's perspectives and avoid all this? So it is not only the right thing to do, I think, you know, to in terms of a proper democracy, but it's also the right thing politically to do, you know.
And I'm trying to think now, I mean, it's been a bit of a blur the last few days, of which perhaps more later, but you know how many people actually did say that was the ideal way to deal with this, was to put it to a citizens assembly. I think in fact, this is a weird moment. I was at Bishop Stortford railway station waiting for a train to oddly end. This is kind of how it goes. And there was 40 minutes or something. So I thought I would try and breeze out of the station, get my pal that I was staying with, a bunch of flares, and kind of get back in time. So I asked the guard if that was all right. And, you know, he says, so I jumped out, got some flares back in. And he kind of caught my accent a bit and kind of actually, you know, there was nobody there because it was semi-strikes all the time. So you got, you know, there was a sort of, I don't know, will there be a train? Won't there now? The day I went down, there were no trains on paper. When I finally got to Gatwick, there was one train in the next hour and a half, and an unbelievable crowd of people waiting for that single train. And then they moved it three times. They changed the platform. And really, I was pretty stressed by that point, because I'd had a journey down where the Fourth Road Bridge was suddenly shut because of Storm Kathleen. So I'd had to, instead of just leaving the car, getting the bus to the airport as normal from Ferrytoll, and Bob is your veritable relative, I ended up having to juke off with all the other blooming traffic going at 20 miles an hour behind a tractor round the other way, the Kincardine Bridge, and come back, you know, just in time now for the plane. So I had to leave the car in the cheapest possible place, and believe me, 2 days parking in something like the NCP is 95 quid. If you haven't booked it, and you can't book it if you're in the 2 hour window before arrival. It's like, I've never taken the car to the airport, so I had no idea actually that this was all, you know, going on. So I ended up putting it in the cheapest place possible, and then having a half hour jog, and I don't jog, right? So this is like watching a cow run for half an hour, basically, with a rucksack. By the time I got there, I mean, to say I was a bit buckled is putting it mildly.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the plane was delayed by an hour. So
naturally,
you arrive in Gatwick, and basically there's a train strike. So you're with all this bunch of people who are tired. You know, they've got bairns, they've got pushchairs, they've got luggage, and they're having to move it three times. The escalator doesn't work. It's 10 o'clock at night. You know, if this one doesn't arrive, are we all going to just sleep on the platform? And before anyone says, I couldn't take a train down because there was a train strike. And this is kind of the thing as well, because I looked at this and I don't know what the situation. Well, the ScotRail site was saying that on Saturday, the ASLEF strike was having no effect in Scotland. Now, I don't know how that's true, because ASLEF strikes have had an effect here before. But my God, it was just chaos down the road. And it brought you into this, you know, talked about this before, about the avoidance of strikes. You need to get, you need to put yourself back into a domain where sort of train strikes are so regular that you know, people are kind of almost inured to it, basically. But the level of panic that it induces when you aren't sure if anything's going to work. After the program I did, there was a taxi taking me to Victoria to get on my way up to see my pal. And, you know, he tried to tell me that there was, again, rail strikes that day and that nothing was working, not even the underground. So I phoned back to the producer because he was trying to say, oh, look, I'll just take you there, which would have been a mega, mega taxi bill, you know. Mm-hmm. So I phoned the producer and he said, no, they won't care. It's all right. You don't need to phone them. And I thought, I really smell a massive rat here, you know. So I phoned the producer and he said, no, we can't really afford that. Like, it would have been unbelievable. And also, actually, the trains are working normally today. And so they were.
Right.
So it's like, this is okay. If you're there, you're so aware now, probably, of what serious strikes mean, semi strikes, whether it's the underground, whether it's the overground, which of the vast assortment of blimmin' private operators it is that's affected most by something, and whether you can take a different line, and whether, you know, if you come in like an innocent into the midst of all that, it's like being chucked sideways into a blimmin' hurricane, you know. So, back to our man on the platform. So your man basically says to me, he says, so you're Scottish? And I said, aye. And he said, oh, where about you come from? So anyway, the long and short of it was his grandfather had basically been a Leith docker and had married a lassie here, had then gone down to London, to Tillsbury or whatever, for work, and had never gone back. So he basically abandoned his family in Scotland and ended up coming down the road and getting married again. And in them days, you know, nobody was keeping track of it, basically. Yeah. So we ended up having this 20-minute conversation about everything to do with dockers, men abandoning families, Scotland and what it was like. He'd come back to try and find his Leith heritage and so on. But the whole thing began with this single observation. So you can't say anything in Scotland now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, that is the top line that everybody has now got, that somehow the Scots are kind of, you know, nanny state central. That you can't say what you think. I mean, because I was completely versed with everything ready for this Trevor Phillips program, which didn't even bother, you know.
No.
I mean, I was dreading having to get into the hate crime bill stuff. And that wasn't even raised, you know. There was hardly anything about Scotland in it. We're just not even interesting when there's a bit of a rammy on, you know.
No.
But you've got to remind yourself that in it there is this kind of, you know, the phrases that you can... you're allowed to shock, offend and disturb in your comments. Now, I'd not like to be the person at the other end of trying to square that with the other bit of it, you know, but that's sort of what it is. But it's not down the road. That's not what anyone's got. They've just got probably that we're, you know, subsidy junkies, because that one's never gone away, that we have all these privileges that people in England haven't, despite the fact that our budgets have to balance so that, you know, you're making choices to have that happen. And now that we are kind of like a nanny state that nobody can say what they think about, hee-haw. So I kind of roundly disabused him of that one, and we then had a very jolly conversation, at the end of which he said if he'd been in Scotland, he would have voted for independence. Boom!
Yes. Well, it was the thing you say, because I noted that Frances Barber, the actor, she's a notorious tweeter. She says, I've got friends up in Scotland. It must be like living in East Berlin before the wall came down. On what planet is this? You know, on a more serious note, though, again, it's that kind of thing, is going back to the whole situation with the strikes. It's the paradox of devolution, Leslie, in the sense that any success, and you compare it and contrast yourself with what's going on in Wales, I mean, for example, to do the health service and the strike situation. No, you can't compare yourself with that. But anything that goes wrong up here is an absolute disaster. So, I mean, you're given absolutely no credit for anything that goes right. So, but you've got all the things that go wrong being laid on the shoulders of not just the Scottish Government, but SNP. And in terms of, and in Hamza Yousaf, when it comes to things like the Hate Act, you know, where it is, as I said, when talking about Anna Sarwar, a big boy did it and ran away, being utterly silent on this, as has Alex Cole Hamilton.
I think there's another thing, actually, from having been down the road for this, and I have to seriously wonder, actually, whether this is a thing to do. I mean, we're sitting with that Copernicus unit or whatever, saying that March has been the warmest, you know, March in the world ever. And okay, it wasn't in Scotland, you know, but then that was always the prediction that what we would get would just be much wetter winters. And by gum, you know, that's been true. And you sort of think, right, is this a good use of plant resources to send one person, viz. Me, down? I mean, okay, if there isn't strikes on and there are trains available, then, you know, I'll take the train down. That's a 15-hour round trip to be essentially speaking for a total of probably 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, I think, you know, the COVID crisis has probably focused that. I always thought people should be thinking about this kind of thing with relation to climate change, because we're all running around for formats that make it look like we're all sitting on each other's knees, because that looks cozy and it's what broadcasters want. And I can see that, you know, it looks, everything's about the look for TV and it looks better. You've got to say, though, you know, the Sunday show on BBC Scotland, most of the time is interviewing people on big screens, because that way you get the right guest. This way you get the guest who is near you, or, you know, I mean, I have to say the other, I kind of got the feeling that the other panelists had just cruised in. I mean, you know, we're really, really relaxed. I kind of had their baffies on and it was like, I'd gone over, you know, crossing the Andes by frog to get down there. And I sort of feel like I'm going to have to say to them, I just don't think I can do this again, because you can't justify it. You know, and the other, there's a point as well where the level of stress, I mean, I'm joking about it now, but every bit of this, I was just limp with the stress of missing something, and kind of the horror of having to elbow your way to the front of stuff, you know, to get on things and fight your way for a seat because you don't know after, you know, I just can't do this anymore. I did this for kind of, I can't remember, is it 5 years, 10 years when I was younger in the 1990s? And ironically, I was on with Trevor Phillips. We used to do the midnight hour, never the same night, but he did one night, I did another night. You know, we used to meet up, the lefties basically used to meet up. And it's strange to think how times have changed. But the thing that has changed is the centre of political gravity. I mean, honestly, probably the last time I really properly saw Trevor was 30 years ago. And so it's a strange one, because this coming into, oh gosh, you know, any attempt to sort of tackle, you know, the hate crime idea looks automatically to an English voter, citizen, as kind of the Stasi state. But then they're looking at, actually, there's a new unit being cracked out by the UK government, which is sending out a whole new set of people to snoop around about people on benefits. There was a story in The National, which is going to have people based in Edinburgh and Glasgow to basically snoop around and see what people are doing with benefits. And they're also putting a law, I haven't got the name of it in front of me now, a new bit of law through the Commons right now, allowing the state, as it were, to demand that banks turn over information about benefits claimants and their rallies. So I don't know, where's the Stasi state in all of this? You know, it's like right under your nose. And if we're going to go a bit further on that, fining homeless people £2,500 if they smell a bit rank because they've actually been sort of living on the streets for God knows how long. I would see that as a lot more offensive and Stasi-like, you know, than if we're going to get into that. But the centre of gravity has moved so much towards sort of individual behavioural identity kind of issues, the culture wars, which is another phrase I don't really feel I understand properly. But all of that stuff, so that's what people click on to. That's authoritarianism. That's, you know, the thing that's going to characterise a country. And all these other things are just administrative. You know, that somehow doesn't constitute a bullying state that has got no time for basically anyone who's not in full possession of the amount of money needed to get you out of the collapse of public services south of the border. Having said that, just to be fair, I did feel, I mean, God, it was an amazing thing to have a day without rain and actually the sun was out, you know, so what I mean? And kind of, you know, the taxi came and got me at 7 o'clock in the morning or something. You're going through the middle of London. It's beautiful. The blossom trees are all out. It was quiet. Actually, there's a half marathon or something on. So there was the beginnings of people kind of gathering for that. You know, and it was tidy. It was tidy. There was no litter compared to what I remember, and obviously a very limited bit of London.
Yeah.
But you know, it was a kind of, you know, it felt kind of pretty and under control, and maybe, you know, the congestion charging has had an effect. It must have had an effect on air quality. But still, it's just a kind of, you know, it feels like a bit of a rat race. And the other thing that applies to Scots is that when it comes to, for example, let's come back to this question of climate. As I understand it, quite a number of funders are now saying, and you know, I'd say quite rightly, that if you're, you know, there's no more refunding money for internal flights in Britain. Okay. For going to meetings or going to discuss stuff. And of course, you're always going to London. You know, it's not that it ever goes the other way around, right? So what it means is, for anybody who is going for meetings, they are having, okay, if you're in Glasgow or Edinburgh, it's shorter, it's 5 hour, you know, 5 hours each way. But this is, it's something that's being added on as a time cost. You know, you're going to end up at a situation where a lot of Scots will probably not bother ending up going to quite a lot of these meetings, because in the end, it's hard to justify totally, you know, that amount of time and expense. And so, but it's certainly the right thing to do as far as the planet's concerned. But it's just this thing again of the tension between putting stuff on Zoom and being serious about it, or actually having in-person meetings, which basically does kill the planet or ends up with a tiny sort of cross-section of who you can possibly invite, viz. People who are within a taxi distance of you, and then leaves the people who are at a distance with just planet-killing journeys to kind of join something for 5 minutes. Yeah. And that, I mean, it was always like that, but now it's like that with knobs on.
Yeah. Well, it was just the thing I was thinking about, what part of the tension when you were talking about the journey there. I'm just actually thinking to myself, how the tension that must be knowing that you're on a significant political Sunday morning flagship show with Trevor Phillips, and you are representing Scotland. You know, that's the reality. You've been invited because you are on the left, an independent supporting Scot. And that's why you're there. And it must have been incredible. I mean, I was just thinking about it because I did. I'll share this with you. On Sunday, I couldn't watch it live for various reasons. But what I did is I did it on catch up this morning. And I'd got through the Oliver Dowden and I got through the David Lammy. Leslie got in touch with me and I said, I'm watching. She said, well, stop it now. You know, just don't anymore. But it was, again, but seriously, that tension must be there constantly to know that beyond your garden. You talked about David Lammy having to think things through and how this is going to be taken in terms of his responses to the questions we've been asked by Trevor Phillips. Do you not often feel in that position yourself, or is it?
Okay, you've no idea. And this is what it is. I've actually been doing this, you know, for such a long time. But I prepped, as it were, for that, you know, 4 minutes of whatever it all amounted to of stuff, as if I was going for finals. You know,
yeah.
And in the end, it was kind of a bit like having the 11 plus in the level of that, you know, so few things drilled into any level of detail. But I mean, I can, you know, I had everything sort of sorted in my, you know, in my head about any number of stuff, things that might have come up. If the strikes had come up, I had to remember exactly when the health unions accepted pay deals, 2022, junior doctors settled last summer, you know, walkouts, Scottish schools last, you know, ended last year. How many franchises have been renationalised on trains in England? 4. You know, have they got the highest prices in Europe? Check. Yes, they have. And that's just something that didn't come up. You know what I mean? And then you go through all the rest of it. You try and remember the phrases, you know, sort of Rachel Reeves and her praise for Thatcher for delivering supply side reforms. And, you know, you've got to get that lodged into your brain so that it comes out easily. There wasn't a moment. You know, if we got on to serious discussion about whether or not we're going to, you know, ban arms sales, there was a point raised last week that actually imports seem to be a bigger factor. Nobody's going to discuss. We never got there either.
No.
So it's kind of, and then I made it, in fact, the coach sent me some information about health in case anybody had a swipe at our health service being worse performing than everybody else. And just by the by, you know, so I now have it in my head, Scotland's core A&Es have been the best performing in the UK for 8 years. just on other things, you know, like sort of, well, that horrible phrase, bed blocking, but delayed discharges.
Yeah.
You know, England's 42% worse. So if anybody had come at me with anything, and my brain is sitting with, it's like a tree, like an empty tree with no leaves on it, with just a little tiny piece of information hanging on each branch, a little twiglet, basically. And honestly, the smallest little breeze that, you know, goes through it all, and you think, no, don't tell me anything else, because my brain is crammed with stuff. And then what you have to do is not sound like that. You have to have it all in there. Yeah. But sounded relaxed enough to pick up something in the moment. And I just thought, I'm too old for this. I cannot, when I was younger, I thought this was part of the job and you just had to do it. The level of stress, I suppose the other way of doing it is just be as cavalier as everybody else. You know, roll in and say, who's on today? Oh, yeah, you know, and just take it as it comes. But, you know, it always feels like as the Scot, you'll just be caught out because it's their world, not your world.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, they're living in it all the time. So they're topping up their knowledge all the time in a way that, you know, when you're it's so, so clear to me how other country-ish Scotland war is, because it requires you to just get so skilled in a lot of stuff, which is just of no interest to anybody down the road at all. I mean, there was one question after an interview with your man who's replacing Leo Varadkar, and suddenly his name skipped out of my head.
Simon Harris?
That's the man, Simon Harris from Fine Gael. There was a long interview with him, and one question about it, which was just kind of, it's nice to see that there's going to be a bit more discussion with the UK now. And you think, right, okay. After everything Britain did to Ireland, vis-a-vis Brexit, and Boris nearly dumping Northern Ireland completely in it, breaking international law. Yeah, things probably did get a bit frosty. I wonder who you might feel that was, you know, was responsible for that one. And that was it, you know. So I don't think it's I'm sure, you know, it's very possible they'll decide that they've got better things to do with, you know, a couple of hundred quid than finance me coming down the road again. So it's very possible it's not something they want to do. But I just don't think that's justifiable anymore. And we need to find Scots in London who can go on network programmes and basically, you know, come up to speed and do this job, because it's going to be there for the next year, at least the next couple of years.
Well, that's the reality. I mean, and again, I thought it was the focus. I mean, other than the Angela Rayner thing, which I'm not going to go into because it's, I mean, I just think that's another complete mishandling by the Labour Party in general, and Angela Rayner in particular. This could have all been scotched, I think, if she'd just come up and said, I made a mistake. However, but we know from previous experience with other people, such as Michael Matheson, the ability of somebody to come out and say a mistake was made and let's just scotch it, and before it actually gets started and develops arms and legs. But the thing about it was that it did tie into your latest article, I thought, in the National, Leslie, when they did focus on the Arinsale aspect of it and the conduct of the Israeli Defence Force and the Israeli government in Gaza. And I was quite taken aback by quite how straightforward but Gitto Hari was. I mean, that for people who don't know, Gitto Hari, who was the communications advisor for Boris Johnson, both as mayor and when he moved into number 10, was very strong in his condemnation of the actions of the Israeli government and the conduct of the IDF in Gaza. And totally, I think, as I can recall, was in favour of an immediate arms ban.
Yes. It's just surprising. And actually, when you look through a lot of the material, it's surprising to see the Tories coming out of the woodwork a bit on this stuff. I mean, we went through some of the names last week. But, you know, in addition to that, Alan Duncan, who is a wee shite. Right. But anyway,
yes, exactly.
But anyway, he's Lord Alan Duncan now. I mean, who isn't, basically? But to give him his due, he is now being investigated by the Conservative Party with a view to chucking him out for an interview he did. And I can't remember what it was on now, but I came in on it. It could have been on the PM program or something. And I sort of thought, who the hell is this, actually? Because he was really going for it. Yeah. And I couldn't believe it was him. But he was basically saying that, you know, he was talking about a culture of impunity in the IDF, that there'd been violation of command, you know, over and over and over again. But his big thing was that the West had basically primed the entire thing to happen by turning a blind eye to the settler issue within Israel, West Bank, Palestine, and that by just not acting when slowly the Israelis basically just annexed land illegally and allowing that to happen. And he had all the statistics, actually, of how many illegal occupations mm-hmm. there were and over which period, you know, it had doubled, trebled, quadrupled to where it is now. And he said, you know, this is basically, this is firing Hamas. This is totally driving support. And none of us gave a toss. And that's a Tory, you know. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of fairly resigned. I mean, obviously, there's nothing to be lost by getting kicked out of the Tories. That's like getting kicked out of a kind of, you know, sinking ship when there is yeah. still kind of, you know, it's still possible to swim to land, probably, you know. Yeah. So it's not exactly a big loss for him. But, you know, that's quite a position for him to have. And of course, Alicia Cairns, who is the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, is the one who is still insisting that the government has seen legal advice saying yeah. essentially that it's acting in contravention of international law because that's where Israel is, so that you cannot now continue arms sales because you're knowingly abetting a country that is violating international law. So she's standing firm on that, despite a lot of people kind of, you know, oh, well, it probably wasn't that clear and it was a bit woolly and whatever. I mean, Cameron is off in the States at the moment. He's just been at the G7. Mm-hmm. He's off in the States. And according to the latest news, he was in actually visiting Donald Trump in Mar-a-Lago, you know, the base, which mm-hmm. is a bit, you know, and actually I can't remember how many years it is before, you know, since any. And of course, Cameron was extremely outspoken, actually, about Trump back in the day. But of course, that's all bygone. So he's in kind of slightly stroking that ego with a view to going into where he is now, I think, where he's gone into the Senate and into, yeah. you know, the American Parliament, and is trying to force through the release of 60 billion quid for the Ukrainians yeah. who are just quietly going down right now. And all of it's got logged down because of Republican, you know, basically playing games with kind of blocks of money. So his efforts over there are to try to kickstart that, presumably having got a bit of consensus from the Europeans, who are also with NATO. Jens Stoltenberg kind of came out with a thing that maybe we should be squaring our own cash now, and maybe there should be a sort of European kind of the Ukraine money should be filtered through NATO and not through a mm-hmm. sort of American, informally led American group. So, I mean, you can see how widely ranged my reading was at 4 a.m. on Sunday morning, right? Yes. So there's all these kind of slow cogs kind of working around the place. And that's the Tories. So then you get Labour.
Oh, yeah.
And that David Lammy interview was just shocking.
Yeah.
It was like a guy who absolutely could hardly make a fluent sentence up, because he was absolutely editing as he was going, trying to remember the lines he'd been told not to cross, and trying not to commit Labour to anything. And at the same time, knowing that he needs to emote, darling, because otherwise very angry people who have just had it with Labour and their loss of any kind of moral compass over Gaza and Israel, are clearly organising alternative candidates. You know, there was another batch of councillors last week who That's just right, resigned yeah. from the Labour Party in the north of England and are just standing as independents now. You know, this is really bad for them. So he needs to stick to this kind of line that, you know, we're not going to rock the boat. We totally support Israel and whatever mealy-mouthed rubbish there is about pauses and stuff like that. And at the same time, look like he really cares about the fact that people are starving.
Yeah.
And it's you can't do it. You know, it was just really dreadful. And I thought, wow, this guy is a year away from being the next foreign secretary.
And of course, that was his excuse. That was his rationale for behaving the way he did, and all these nuanced positions that they took, which actually boils down to the fact that initially, Israel can do what it likes. And I will never forget that interview with Keir Starmer on LBC, where he was asked directly about, did Israel have the right to cut off food, water, electricity? Israel has the perfect right to defend itself. And again, that's the reality of it. No matter how they twist the fact, And again, it's now being represented, I mean, as all political parties do, but it's now being represented the fact that it was the Labour Party who actually got the ceasefire motion through Parliament, a ceasefire motion, which was actually an amendment to the motion of the SNP that the Labour Party had umpteen opportunities to bring before and did not. And again, the other thing, you obviously watched them as well, was Pat McFadden being asked about support for Israel and the contempt. We'll just have to wait and see. And are they breaking this? And are they doing that? Well, for God's sake, folks, it took a nanosecond to condemn what Russia was doing illegally in Ukraine. It took a nanosecond. Nobody had to think about it.
But well, that's the other thing that I'm suddenly remembering that Alan Duncan has said, where he basically said that the Conservative Friends of Israel is running the Conservative Party on this, and Labour Friends of Israel, Labour. Yeah. And that the Friends of Israel groupings within these two parties have for such a long time had incredibly, I mean, in fact, if I had the time now, there's been investigative evidence even about funding for prominent members of the cabinet. I can't remember what proportion of them have got funding from some of those kind of backgrounds, but it's pretty blooming high. So there's all of that sitting there. But just as you say, to go back to the words, the words that Keir Starmer, and think about this for a minute, because when he said that, you know, that he thought Israel had the right to block water, fuel and food reaching Gaza, where are we now? We're at starvation. And what will constitute most likely a war crime? Actually, it's the starvation more than the pounding and the military action. Yeah. So that actually he didn't doubtless realise it. But he was, and I'm not suggesting that something that a leader of the opposition said in a different country, you know, it's not going to have a direct impact. But he green lighted exactly what's happening now.
Yeah.
And that's what to me is absolutely shameful, because he's supposed to be a human rights lawyer, you know, so that if other people are picking their way carefully through words, if you've spent most of your life in that framework of thinking, you don't idly say anything like this because you understand what the repercussions can actually be. And similarly, David Lammy, let's just not forget, said that the Israeli bombing of the Jabalia refugee camp could be legally justified if there was a military objective. Yep. So it's just, you know, as you say, I cannot now unhear that. And it's strange because, you know, down the road, it's like everybody has kind of gone, yeah, well, OK, bygones. That was a wee while ago. I don't know if we're just like kind of no surrender on the kind of moral front. You know, I know this is mixing metaphors, but, you know, it's like just really hard taskmasters. And it's quite possible other people will have moved on, can't quite remember. I don't know. I don't think so.
No. I mean, and just as a bit of note, I don't know if you noticed, I mean, I may not pass across here with all the other work that you've been doing, that a young man called Jack Lunar has just been elected chair of Young Labour. And it just so happens that his dad, Gary Lubner, was a 4.5 million donor to the Labour Party. And what's coming out about it, I mean, he's a pro-Israeli, he's Zionist, as is his son, who's a member of the Jewish Labour movement, which you do not have to be a member of the Labour Party nor Jewish to be part of it, which has been one of the elements external to the Labour Party, which I think created that anti-Semitic witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn and those who support them, including vast numbers of Jewish socialists who have now been expelled from the Labour Party. But Lubner's family background is very interesting because they played an important role in busting international sanctions in South Africa in the 1980s. Lubner was a member of the police force when he was in South Africa in 1977. The family firm donated to the ruling National Party, the organisers, creators and implementers of apartheid. And so there you go now. So that young man who has led a campaign against BDS, who worked for pro-Israel lobbyist Ruth Smith when she was an MP, that young man, you know, lo and behold, your dad gives 4.5 million quid to the Labour Party and you're elected chair of Young Labour. And that's the reality of it, is that, and it just goes back to it, is because, of course, what happened when Starmer took over and broke all these promises, vast numbers of members, ordinary members, who contributed significant amounts of money to the Labour Party left, and money was no longer coming in, and lo and behold, Labour turned to big business. And look what 4.5 million will get you. And that's and I'm fed up being mealy-mouthed about it, Leslie.
Yeah, but if anybody does get a sort of, because there was definitely a twitchiness on that programme about the amount of, you know, criticism there was about the Israelis. I can't remember the name of the guy who came on who's just spoke over Trevor, you know, trying to ask him a question five times. I don't think the Israeli spokespeople do themselves any favours by coming on. And it's a strange thing because it's almost like there's vague ground rules for how you do a kind of interview. But to come on at 100 miles an hour, pitched up with utter anger towards the interviewer before you started, and to speak over them the entire way, and to deny any of the hurt that happens, that's happened on the other side that we've all seen, it's just you stop listening. So that there may be in there the nano sort of beginnings of some point. I think the guy was trying to make some point about why the Red Cross hadn't gone to try and check on the hostages in Gaza. Now, I mean, OK, maybe there's a tiny point in there, but like it was completely covered in how angry he was that he couldn't get that, you know, he could. And he was trying to demand that of an aid worker who was also on the programme. It wasn't his shout, you know what I mean? But he was yelling at the guy. So you end up with this. You just can't hear any of the points that are being made now from the Israeli point of view. And obviously, with Netanyahu now saying he's named a date for the invasion of Rafah, it's like, what the fuck? I mean, it's just outrageous. And obviously, that's it within his coalition. The right is now kind of saying, oh, he's weak because he hasn't actually named the date. So he's had to come out and look tough to just put a date down. I mean, this is all provoking, you know, the Americans. And in fact, there was a lot of speculation that the bombing that looks like it was an Israeli attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus.
Yes.
Right. Which killed seven guys, Iranian guys. It, you know, many people, I think David Pratt at the weekend was openly sort of saying, yeah, that just looks like the Israelis are trying to provoke the Americans to come back on side. Because, you know, the Americans have got history, everyone's scared of the Iranians. So you kind of make it look like these guys, where the Iranians came out and said, you know, there will be retaliations. So everyone thinks, oh, my God, wider theater of war, the Iranians kind of up and at it active. But, you know, between the two, if you like, evils, the Iranians and the, you know, Netanyahu-led Israeli government, which way do we go? And that level of calculation and manipulation seems to be where we are with it all now. But anyway, we need to watch this space because Westminster is still out this week, but they're back next week. Cameron's done enough blooming globetrotting to, you know, have got where things are at. And there will be a lot of pressure now. And ironically, coming mostly from the Tories and the SNP, obviously, to drive through an arms ban.
Yeah. I mean, just on that Netanyahu thing, I happened to listen to a Radio 4 interview with Shelley Tal-Maron of Yesh Atid, the centrist moderate party in the Israeli Knesset. And no compunction in actually being wholehearted, 100% what the IDF was doing was absolutely correct. So there may be thousands of people on the street protesting about Netanyahu, about his inabilities and the incompetence of the security arrangements and his inability to get the hostages home. But let us be in no doubt whatsoever that if anyone thinks getting rid of Netanyahu will diminish what is going on in Israel in terms of their perspectives on Gaza and what's going to happen with that wreckage, the absolute wreckage, no universities, no schools, no hospitals anymore, total destruction of infrastructure and people going back to it. So there will be no change in the political direction of Israel. They are wholeheartedly in favour of what is going on in Gaza.
Except that, you know, there's still this, I totally agree, except that so much of the public now wants a deal done to get the hostages back.
Yes.
You know, the deal's done. So, yeah, you can kind of have, we've said this right from the start, you get some Palestinians released who will very possibly just be arrested again in a month. You know, so it's I'm not arguing that, you know, in some longer term way, this is where these pauses is just, you know, that this needs to be something that allows space, political space, for something almost unimaginable to happen. But it also needs a change of government. You know, if it's going to be September, which is what Benny Gantz is talking about. And my God, you know, when you end up thinking that you kind of. So but a fresh person in will presumably not have, well, will not walk down the same kind of dead end that Netanyahu has done, because he hasn't got any of his, you know, he hasn't got his guys back. Anyway, enough of that.
Yes.
It's awful.
Yeah. Yes. And those of you who are astute listeners will remember that right at the end of last week's podcast, I said, and yes, next week, I promise you, we will be talking about land reform. And so, yeah, if you've been sticking with us, I think we're about 45 minutes in. And yes, we are going to be talking about land reform, the Land Reform Act, because even though the Scottish Parliament is not in session, this the land reform has been brought before. Now, Sarah Jane Leng, the chief executive of Scottish Land and Estates, said the new measures were a destructive, full-on attack on the property rights of owners and would be counterproductive. But the Scottish National Party said it will revolutionise land ownership in Scotland by empowering rural and island communities and increasing transparency and large land transactions. And, you know, you were prepped for Trevor Phillips, Leslie. Which of these two statements, either of them, are true?
But sadly, they're both wrong. I mean, this will, you know, this land reform bill, as it's still trundling through, will not revolutionise anything. And it isn't, you know, sort of Zimbabwe on stilts or whatever it is that the landowners kind of come up with. The object of it, you know, there's lots of bits. It's land reform in a net zero nation is the kind of, you know, consultation paper it's based on. But the idea was to try to stop the transfer of large land holdings off the market, or as it's referred to as off-market sales, which happens a lot. And then when those sales now have to be done properly, as it were, on the market and not done privately, it introduces a public interest test at that moment, which allows ministers to swing in and say, this is a bit our big, this 2% of the land mass you've got, honey. We need to kind of break this up a bit into lots so that it can get broken down, and that, you know, that should help to break up the horrible situation, which Andy Whiteman has reassessed and done the numbers and discovered that after all this time, since 2012, the number of private owners owners of private land in Scotland is the same. It's basically 432, as was in fact corrected to 440 when he got a bit more information, and now it's 433. So we've had all this since 2012. So that is 12 years of going through all sorts of different bits of legislation which has not changed the overall situation. Within those statistics, there has been change. You know, there are now, if you like, there has been big landowners like the Duke of Buccleuch has sold off bits and bobs, so that there's now more green lairds in there, sort of mixing it. But fundamentally, we have the most concentrated land ownership pattern in possibly the world, certainly the developed world. No change after all the fiddling on the margins. So coming back to this thing, if you then have this public interest test, the trigger for that was going to be the area of land. Now, at the beginning, the Scottish government was proposing 3,000 hectares. And I'll quite grant you, I can't even visualise what that is myself. But very pretty big, right? So that then was almost, some people think that was just an opening sort of salvo so that it got brought down to 1,000 hectares. So if something is being sold 1,000 hectares, it triggers this public interest test where ministers could swing in if they swing and decide that the thing has to be broken up into lots and that the community gets potentially a right to buy. Now, that all sounds groovy, but there's a number of big, big problems with this. First of all, poor communities that are sitting with no resource whatsoever and are expected to swing into action at the drop of a hat to suddenly enable themselves to jump in and buy whatever bits of, you know, lots are available in their neck of the woods. This is a bit like sort of, you know, thinking that the whole population is basically as fit as Usain Bolt, just waiting for a 100-metre opportunity. We're not. And there's nothing down there. There's no support for anybody and communities are absolutely being worn out. So nano problem number one. Second problem is this threshold. Most people argued for it to be halved to 500 hectares so that there would be more of a chance of kind of seeing some action, you know, in all of this. But the other bigger, far bigger problem of it all, which again is something that Andy has pointed out, is that you know, this can suit a private estate's big Jim Dandy to basically have it all broken up into lots. They just buy lots of little bits. So that it's basically like you still have a big plate of food in front of you, but it's just like lots of, you know, you went up to the buffet 10 times. So he has, for example, looked at a London-based asset management company called Gresham House. Andy figures it's the fifth largest private landowner in Scotland. Ever heard of it? I hadn't.
Nope.
And the point is that it's got about 50,000 hectares spread over 160 separate landholdings. And anybody who was watching, when you look at the Teignmouth Castle debacle and the big American company that swung in there, it's just been going around buying lots of little bits all around that part of Perthshire, so that it ends up with a pretty big contiguous bit of land, and it'll just wait for the guys who are in the middle to cough up. So why, whether this would help at all to have this kind of, you know, broken up into smaller bits thing is really very questionable. Two other things. The crucial issue of land taxation shunted into the long grass. Shameful, shameful, shameful. It's the only thing that's going to change anything. And the extraordinary thing is when you look then back at where we've got over all this time, not only have we got the figures that show that, you know, that the small number of people who own the private land of Scotland has not changed really one iota, but let's look at community owned land. And basically, it has grown by, and I know this is a lot of hectares here, but it's grown by 40,000 hectares over 10 years. And that is kind of a really minute amount of change in relative terms, so that, you know, it's really slowed down is the main point. And the reason for that is because the price of land is through the roof. Because of the green layers, the carbon offsetting, the fact that land, you're not just basically, it's not just essentially a wet wilderness. There's some crofters there and there's a landowner who's hardly around very much. That all sort of set up until the shooting and then all the kind of, you know, pals weigh in and suddenly you can be arrested for looking at a river with something that resembles a rod. That old situation is now not it, because you've got these other guys in the side, the green lairds, who are bidding up, essentially bidding up the price of land. And it means that communities will never be able to buy, you know, will never be able to, they'll swipe the whole Scottish land fund to buy something the size of egg. So really, this is a really sore effect. All the stuff, especially that Andy and Community Land Scotland have been arguing for, to include inherited land in some of this, to include company share transfers to properly taxed land, to have really greater support for community buyers. All of that has been, is not in this act. So basically, I'm not saying nul point, but one.
Yeah. I mean, because looking at it, Andy's also claiming that the public interest test has been dropped. That, so it's a transfer test, whatever that means. And I couldn't actually find out whatever that meant. But some of the other things, and I'm grateful to Craig Dale of Commonweal for this, because he noted that within this framework, if a delay to sale has been comes about because of the effects of the introduction of the Land Act, is you can have public compensation for landlords if they lose out financially as a result of the estate being lotted. So as he says there, look, if your estate is 10 million estate is broken to lots, you're only able to sell them for 8 million. The Scottish government may well pay you the difference. So that's up to that one. And the other thing that Andy brought into to bearing was the fact that if you want to complain about the community engagement obligations for owners of land holdings over 3,000 hectares, again, that coming in there, that's got to be land management plans, how you go about outdoor access, code of practice, deer management, how the land is managed, the contribution to net zero. Community councils and individuals can't report any breaches. You know, you can't report any breaches. If you're an individual, it's got to be done with three very specific, again, I couldn't find out who exactly they were, bodies. And the fines for this are minimal.
£5,000 or something. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's absolute nonsense. So again, it's just this fact of the sense of disappointment, Leslie. And I know that Commonweal have produced a paper again. I'm going to be having a looking at it in more depth, which is to do with property taxation and the way that could be introduced both for land and for property and as a replacement for council tax, and it'd be far more progressive, particularly in the Highlands and Islands, where the land property taxation would kick in, and would actually provide significant funding. For example, they claim that would actually cover the shortfall as it currently exists in Highlands Council. So in terms of its funding. So again, another rattling disappointment, Leslie, and this string of disappointments where action could and should have been taken. And again, it just asks the question, why, and again, with all sorts of other areas, is the Scottish Government so feared in these areas, when so determined in all sorts of other areas to be radical in terms of the perception of what they're doing?
Honestly, I just don't know. I mean, people keep asking that. The suggestion, I think, that Colin Wheel and probably Andy have as well, is how much time, effort, money is spent on lobbying by all the various interests that want to keep things the way they are. But the lawyers, you know, will because the argument at the base of it, anytime I've got halfway near this, and I mean, I am soft-pieced as far as most SNP people are concerned on this front, that they them in run screaming basically if I'm anywhere near it. So I've never had a conversation with anybody relevant about this. But I heard, you know, that the argument simply is that the lawyers automatically say, we've waited too long. The European Convention of Human Rights basically puts property rights very high up the kind of pecking order, and the landowners will play that one in immediately. And I still think, you know, I've said this before, but they said exactly the same about minimum alcohol pricing. Mm-hmm. And the government held its nerve, went to the top, you know, court in Europe and won. And if the worst that happens is, and I really think the Scottish government have got to learn this one, is that if there's a problem sitting there, you've got to not just, you know, I mean, they're not even saying that that's the problem, because, you know, they're just trying to kind of, oh, you know, get everyone in the same room. And this is a legacy from the Nicola period, where it was all about getting stakeholders together. Now, this could be, you know, arguably like sort of, you know, the poacher and the gamekeeper have to sit in a kind of kumbaya ring, you know, and try to find out some sort of common ground between everything. But that is where it was. So you've got all the big old boys with, you know, heavy funding and the landowning fraternity and all the rest of it, and all there, and all the big, you know, forestry companies, because they're all kind of in that as well. And then you've got, you know, a couple of people in open-toed sandals on the other side trying to kind of say, yeah, well, what about the community? Yeah. So it's kind of like that way of coming up, not taking a side, has been the way that the last 10 years have worked on everything. That produces this kind of thing, which I'm sure the Scottish government think they're doing something really kind of, you know, they always seem to think they're doing something radical. That I remember going through exactly this conversation in 2016, I think it was, with the last, you know, woo, look at this one. I can't even remember what it was there, but I think it was that the ministers could swing in if there was evidence of neglect, so that basically, you know, deserted land or neglect that was causing a damage to the sustainability of rural communities. I mean, I remember saying at the time, nobody will use this. Because, I mean, unless you're absolutely confident of getting to dry land, you've taken a pop at a guy who is your employer, landowner, landlord. You know, he probably switches the blooming daylight on and off as well. And that's still the case in most of rural Scotland. And you're going to take a pop at him. And if you aren't sure that you're going to get to the other side, you'll be evicted. You will. So, you know, it's leaving the little people to have levels of courage that people who are on decent salaries in Holyrood and in the civil service do not have.
Yeah.
And that's not the way the world works. You know, and so I sort of challenge anybody who's related to this now, including Mike Russell, who put that 2016 stuff through. Has a single person used the 2016 legislation? Because to my knowledge, not one. So when you get to a stage where you're getting these unusable things that sort of on paper look like they should be able to, you know, it's like somebody constructing a camel instead of, oh, I can't remember what it is, you know, you get a committee in and suddenly you've got something very different from what's workable on the ground. People are are, you know, I'm sitting here, even where we are, I'm sitting on the edge of an estate where people can't speak out about shooting yes. that's going on constantly all over the place, cartridges that are raining down on people's houses from pheasant shoots. I've got a 20 blooming pheasants permanently in my garden, shielding from the bloody guns, you know, in the rest of the estate. Is there anything that we can say about it? No, because if you speak to any of those guys, which takes a lot of confidence to walk up to a set of, you know, deer stalkered guys with guns, right? If you even speak to anybody about it, it's all sublet, you know, so they've no idea yes. who they got it from. And it's not the estate's problem or anything like that. I mean, this is just a tiny little fraction of the problem. People are living in houses that, you know, I go past every day, rented houses here. And when it's been dry, and I'll grant you that's not been very often, but when it's been dry, albeit glowery, for, you know, a week, 2 weeks, there's still a running water coming down in front of them because yes. the drains don't work because they're blocked and the council's given up and they kind of, you know, it's just so yeah. like there's so much that needs to get going and none of this will change with this proposal. None of it.
Yes. So if anybody really wondered what Leslie was going to think about this latest land reform bill, you now know exactly what she thinks. It's just a chip in from, and I do not have that depth of experience, just as simply reading it and then reading the excellent Craig DL and Andy Whiteman's analysis of it, and I will put links up to it. It is a busted flush. It is neither of the things you said right at the beginning. It's neither Zimbabwe on stilts, and it's neither a revolution. So it is a sad, sad disappointment. And in the words of the inimitable saw doctors who come from Galway and Mayo, I look out the window and think to myself, oh God, will it ever stop raining?
Oh, you're going to stop now. No, yes. We'll not see you quite next to you, because there was one thing that was sent in by okay. a listener, and I'm just always right. very keen when somebody's bothered their backside.
That sounds interesting.
Well, it was the one about, it was the mention I made last week about the fact that Thames Water looks like it could be renationalised, and how, you know, it's actually 30 years. It was 30 years in March since the Strathclyde referendum that essentially saved Scottish Water. But I did wonder, I did think there was some aspects of privatisation within the Scottish Water setup. So Kyle, who used to work for Scottish Water, sent me a lot of really useful information. But the net of it is that basically there were PFI sites set up in the 90s. So this was before all of this, for delivering wastewater services, big places like Seafield, Dalry in Glasgow. And Scottish Water inherited these PFI contracts when it was formed as a publicly owned company. So basically, the expectation is that Scottish Water will incorporate them into the core business when the PFIs end in the next 10 to 20 years. Thanks, right. Labour, I think, yeah. for that one.
Yeah.
You know, so that it's another of these ones where you're still sitting with that kind of system. However, he thinks actually these PFIs have been reasonably well funded. I'm sure people will start going Seafield, don't even start, right? But so there's issues there. There was an arm's length company set up by Scottish Water called Scottish Water Horizons. That's because it can operate like a private business and can borrow private money. You know, the core Scottish Water thing, because it's publicly owned, can't. And what it's borrowed money for is investing in renewables, mainly solar and wind, pursuing heat recovery systems for district heating, right?
Whoa.
Nice one. And so the expectation, this was actually where Kyle works, so he knows about this. So the hope is that some of the renewable assets that they've bought can be brought into the core business, so that that essentially will end up as a publicly owned assets, in stark contrast to all the other stuff that's going on at the moment that's basically owned by SSE and SSEN and so on, and drifting off into a private world of its own. So market competition, EU law meant that businesses had to be able to have a competition of water services provided to them. So that's why Scottish Water set up Scottish Water Business Stream to be one of these people that provides okay. services to the private sector. But like the electricity market, it doesn't matter who businesses are buying from. it's Scottish Water who's the wholesaler that's providing the network.
Okay.
So that could be arguably sort of form of privatisation, but still it's Scottish Water at the back of all of this. And the point he's trying to make is the main difference for Scotland has been the much lower consumer cost to Scots for having water. It's partly due to the lack of private profiteering. It's also due to our geography, because since we are a pretty mountainous place, we have a lot of our water that just naturally reaches pumping stations without all, well, mm-hmm. we don't have a lot of pumping stations. It's gravity fed, basically. That puts a lot more cost into the English network, as well as the catastrophe of their private management. And there are the same problems, aging assets, raw sewage discharges, you know, and kind of all of that stuff has to be faced. But we could be facing that as an independent country with an extraordinary asset, with the baseline of owning all the assets, with the prospect of much of it coming back into our control within the next 10 to 20 years. And what we're going to end up doing instead is paying for Thames Valley to go belly up. And I see the latest suggestions are that they're suggesting breaking the company up to avoid renationalisation. It's beyond crazy. So thank you, Kyle, for all of that. And anybody with incredible expertise, you're welcome to join in the train.
Wow. Well, I'm glad I was stopped from closing the podcast there, because it's fascinating stuff. And again, it just shows that goes to show that people know things, Leslie, don't they? And when people know things and they can put it in that way, that suddenly gives you a greater insight into the realities of what's going on. And you talked about the Scotland, the potential of becoming a small independent country. And the way it was going to end as well was to turn around and say, of course, your latest film about Denmark is now available online for anyone who was unable to get to any of the multiple showings and Q&As that have been across the country. I will put the link up to the Denmark movie online, and people can have a wee geek at what a small independent country can actually achieve for itself.
Yeah, and just by the by, there are still a couple of screenings actually still
all
to
right.
go. It's more that the last cinema ones, the big cinema ones, mm-hmm. the Cameo ones last week were amazing. I mean, really, there was not literally almost not a single seat, you know, vacant in the Cameo. So and here's another discovery. I didn't know this, but there were some Danes in the audience who answered this question. Is it the case that only Danes can own land in Denmark? I didn't actually know that, but Danes in the audience said, yes, that's right. And actually, that includes you can't buy property. And in fact, she said, that includes people who haven't lived there. Like, I'm Danish and I can't own property because I'm not living there. Now, I think she felt quite outraged at that, actually. But the audience thought, yeah, dancer.
Yes.
Just went completely bonkers. You know, like, what an enlightened bunch of people these are, you know, that have just decided that there's, you know, that they've screamed out. But this all arose from the fact that the Denmark nearly ceased to exist in 1864 because it picked a fight essentially with Germany, and Germany nearly occupied the whole place. So it's lived in the terror of being essentially bought over bit by bit ever since. And that's why it has that really stiff set of rules about ownership. But that's what you can do if you're an independent country.
On that rallying cry note, we'll see you next week, chums.